Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. There's been a real firestorm around this report that we're about to talk about today that kind of caused this latest call for a conversation. Of course, we're always having these conversations, and I'll read a comment by my dear friend, the poet and scholar Ethelbert Miller, who wrote in response to this, all of this. It's called A Call for Change, put out by the Council of Great City Schools. We are going to talk about today. It's talking about how there's a crisis among young black children living in poverty in America and where that is going, and that if crisis proportions facing America. And, of course, this is no news to those of us who have been living a life in any communities in this country, who have worked with kids in schools, in prisons, in our inner cities. And the problem is that the majority of men who do not graduate high school and who are African American, who are poor, end up in prison or part of our criminal justice system, and more. So we'll talk about all those stats. And Bob Herbert wrote about it in today's New York Times. And as I said, the great poet and scholar Ethelbert Miller from Howard University wrote an interesting response to me about that just a few minutes ago when he heard we were doing this show, and I'll read his response on the air as well. We are joined in studio by Dr. Raymond Winbush, who's director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, and Afra Vance White, who is director of Building Strong Families with the Center for Urban Families, and the Reverend Heber Brown, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church right here in Baltimore. And Dr. Winbush, Reverend Brown, and Ms. White, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And please join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. You know, this report that just came out, we were talking about, and we want to get your thoughts on this because, you know, it in many ways, I think that folks in the inner cities of America, poor, African-American, we're talking about in Baltimore for the most part, dispossessed and forgotten by the rest of America. And now with this great economic crisis, could be forgotten even more. And in this study, one of the things it said in this study is that 70% of children who are African American are born to unwed mothers in the United States of America. A third of all African American children live in poverty, and that's only using the official statistics of what poverty means in America, which means it's a great deal more. That by the time they reach their mid 30s, a majority of black men without a high school diploma has spent some time in prison. That the families are falling apart. They're calling it in this report a national catastrophe. And before I read Ethelbert's response to this, I want to get your sense of take on this, because all of a sudden here we have it, to me, when I read this part of the report, I only had a chance to read the executive summary and pieces of the report. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but enough to know what it's saying. That did it take that much to let us know that we're facing a national catastrophe? This is supposed to be news? That inner-city kids and families are in crisis, and that America's in crisis and going down around this issue? I mean, it just blows my mind. We always have to make this some kind of, like, it's news. Who's it news for, Raymond Winbush?
Well, it certainly isn't news for me, and it's ironic that this stuff comes 45 years, almost to the day of the infamous Moynihan Report that called, you know, the black family a tangle of pathology, and it was a national crisis then. I mean, I don't know. To me, this is like, you know, eating leftovers in terms of the research data. There's nothing new about that. 70% this year, 45 years ago, I believe it was at 64%.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's, this is where I am, and it may reflect some of my jadedness about these kind of data, is that I don't know if it has anything any more to do with issuing a shiny new report as it does with the will to do something about what's contained in the report. There's no will to action relative to the crisis that young black males feel. I've said before, and others have said, that if what was happening to black males was happening to white males, they would have a United Nations conference. And the other thing is this.
It's the truth. I'm only laughing because it's sad.
But it's the
sad truth.
And then the other thing, and I'm going to shut up after this, is that you can go, and these are places I've been in the past couple of years, Paris, London, Australia, Jamaica, black males are in trouble all over the world. So I either have to conclude as a black male there is something incredibly wrong with black males or something incredibly wrong with the systems that they go through from K through 12. And I choose to believe it's the latter. And we talk about intervening with black males, but we really need to talk about intervening with the systems that create this problem in the first place.
Afra, welcome to the program for the first time. Pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I actually agree with Dr. Wimbush. At the Center for Urban Families, we work with a population that is severely impoverished, who have a disconnect with their families in a whole. We work with our Responsible Fatherhood Program, and these are men who owe tremendous amounts of money in child support, yet have no means of being able to pay them. I work with families in general who have no point of reference to grow and develop, and I concur that it is all about education. And really, until we do something about our education system, especially here in Baltimore, we're going to still see this problem permeate throughout the world, throughout this city and the nation.
Reverend Heber Brown.
Thank you, Mark, for having
Good
me.
To see you again.
Great to be here with these great guests. I definitely agree. I think the questions, here's some questions that I would love for us to wrestle with. Just straightforward questions. Are black people genetically inferior to other people on earth? Are we genetically inferior? And if we can answer that question, here's another question. Are we culturally inferior to other people on earth? From this part, from this article from Bob Herbert, at the conclusion of his article, he seems to imply and suggest that black people have a cultural inferiority. That's where he drops his anchor, the last couple of paragraphs,
right,
that it's a cultural thing for black people. And my question is, how do we as African people go from the architects of human civilization in the known world? I mean, you can go to the father of Western history, and Herodotus and others will say that everything they got, the Greece and Rome, they borrowed from the Egyptians.
The Black Athena was a great book that people put down, but it was a very serious book.
And so the question is, how do you go from that point to where we are now? And it begs to Dr. Wimbush's perspective and point, if this is happening all over the world, then I choose to believe that there is a system in place that needs to be addressed systematically. And if there's a raging fire, as Bob Herbert entitles this this article, it's interesting that he calls it a raging fire, but is unwilling to even search out the source of the blaze. Any professional firefighter knows if you're going to fight a fire, one of the first things they do is find out where's the source of the fire. And it's interesting that he, instead of going to the source of the fire, he's swinging at flames and then at the end saying, well, it's the fire's fault that it's burning. I think we have to have some new conversations finally.
One thing I'd have to know, Heber, is that one Sunday I have to come hear you preach.
He's doing it now.
But let me read you what Ethelbert Miller wrote to me. Ethelbert Miller is at Howard University. He's one of the great poets and thinkers, president of the board of directors of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's a really interesting human being. And a friend, I'll add that. See, he wrote me an email when he read that we were going to do this program today. This is what he wrote. And he wrote this actually this morning to Charles Johnson, who's the novelist who wrote The Middle Passage.
Middle Passage.
So this is his letter, his email to Charles Johnson. Then we'll get to the phones at 410-319-8888. He says, another outdated article. Herbert might as well be complaining about For Colored Girls. I get tired of alarms going off whenever a new report is released about race, in this case, black males. We love this stuff. But let's look at what our quote-unquote leaders are not working on. How many folks are talking about prison reform? How many people are talking about, quote-unquote, the changing black family? We talk about the middle class. Do we talk about poverty? Do you know I could talk about the dental health of black boys and scare folks into rationing floss? It just depends on the spin. We keep talking about the same issues and waiting for solutions. The problem right now is that we have hustlers and folks who are brands and not leaders. We don't have dedicated race men like W.E.B. Du Bois, Carter G. Woodson, and Kelly Miller. We have no leaders because we have no movement. If we have become, quote-unquote, unplugged from Obama, we won't even care about citizenship anymore. One thing that no one talks about when it comes to black boys is the absence of a military draft in our community. It's just the mean streets for the majority of the new biggers. B-I-G-G-E-R-S, to be clear,
bigger
in case my mouth didn't work right. The urban educational system fails our young. It is primarily a way for the black middle class to have decent employment. Check out the middle-aged black teachers around the country. Do they talk about retirement and money, or do they talk about educational issues? Many blue-collar jobs are gone, so black boys can only find criminal jobs. As the era of austerity unfolds, things are going to get worse. The poor can't take no more. Bigger will be left standing on a corner watching planes fly overhead. Now here come the quote-unquote leaders of our race walking down the street, ready to sell him a cheap pair of wings. Ethelbert Miller.
Eloquent. And the truth. I mean, it's so, I mean, I couldn't even add anything to what he just said. And frankly, I'm kind of exhausted about these reports, as your friend and our colleague is. I mean, they're almost useless, you know, in the sense of like reciting what we already know and then saying the problem is that we've got to deal with these black boys and that is the problem. Like Brother Heber said, that it's, you know, it's like talking about a fire but not looking at the cause of the fire. And so right now, like, I think it's pretty much useless for people to talk about the problem without, you know, offering solutions. And the solutions usually get offered again. We need to change the public school system, but we don't. We need to change curricula, but we don't. We need to change issues of jobs, but we don't. And then you see things reinforcing the status quo. And then when somebody comes along with a different idea, a more radical idea, I saw it years ago in Chicago with Marva Collins when she intervened and was successful. People denounced them. Well, this is too radical. This is too out of the ordinary. Let's stay with the same old tired curriculum.
I also think that we're kind of not really getting to the issue of the lack of wealth in African-American families in general, and how this is something that is really impacting our communities as a whole. The net worth of a black family in America is $5,988 compared to a white family, which is $88,651. You know, I think that the gentleman who wrote this study and many others are thinking that we can lift ourselves up by our bootstraps, but we don't have any straps to lift ourselves up with. And I think it's important that we start having institutions that are geared toward lifting up our young black men and our young black women. And I think we're starting to see that with Jeffrey Canada, even here in Baltimore with Ann Emory School. I think that we just need to come together as a community and a people and remember what it was like in the 60s. That's a little bit before my time, but I feel like we had more togetherness in the time of Martin Luther King Jr. I think that we all had a cause that we were all fighting for, and I remember it was more black I don't remember, but I hear it was more black businesses, more black people. You only could go to black businesses, and that's kind of that's wealth generating, and that helped communities. So you had a doctor living next to a plumber, living next to a mechanic, and I think we've strayed away from that as African Americans, and we really need to go back to the sense of community and really looking at helping those who are less fortunate than ourselves.
And even in looking at that, and to co-sign the sister, certainly speaking about the need for community unity, I'm even leaving tonight going to a church to continue this dialogue about black men in particular. And Dr. Winbush just is a wonderful elder and just teacher of so many. I was blessed a few years ago to get his book, The Warrior Method, where he talks about rearing healthy black boys. And now I have two black boys of my own. So to have read that book before having my sons, and now I have my sons, and now I can go back and brush up to make sure that they have that sense of identity as African boys in this country is just so important. But also the sister talked about institution building. And Dr. Amos Wilson would often talk about how we can have all the facts and stats and all the great memories about the 60s that we want to, but we'll just die black and proud. And if we just die black and proud, who is that really helping? And he says we really have to start building institutions in our communities whereby we can, instead of searching for the answer outside of ourselves, search within ourselves and create the solutions. So many times, you know, we have these special reports and these experts who tell us what the answers are to our problems. And I think one of the things we need to do in our community is to sit down together and create our own solutions for our own problems, and that whole spirit of self-determination for our people.
Let me just kind of throw some things out here, maybe challenge you, but as we open the phones in the next couple of minutes, and folks do join us here, 410-319-8888. We want to get your thoughts and ideas. And Corey, you're the first caller up in Baltimore County. We're going to come to you, and Jay is coming up. We're going to get to all these calls coming in now. But let me just challenge a little bit here. I mean, I think that when housing stocks were different in America and when segregation was in full bloom in the black community, but also in the white community, the income communities were mixed. You know, on my block growing up, it was the same way. It was the doctor, the small business owner, somebody who worked at Glenel Martin, real estate person, all in the same neighborhood. And America's changed in that way, and I think especially in the African-American community for the worst in terms of what's happening to the children. But let me posit this. I mean, there's a little contradictory stuff here. I mean, there's only so much, I think, that any community on its own can do to kind of pull up the bootstraps don't exist, as you were saying, Afra. And that the issue seems to me is that families began to fall apart at the end of segregation when the jobs also left. Mm-hmm. And there were and jobs is what keep people families together. Either even if, you know, I say this thing sometimes, I thought it'd be a blessing in inner cities if parents were just divorced and fathers were in the lives of children. Not that I want to see people get divorced, but I'm just saying that the bottom line is where's the struggle to create jobs that stabilize the communities that changes the nature of what we face? And I don't think anything changes unless we wrestle with what the future of America is going to be as a whole.
Well, what you had before segregation, you had, as Sister Afra said, you had an intact black community. What Tom Burrell says in his new book, Brainwash, is that you also had a 400-year campaign in this country, an advertising campaign talking about the inferiority of black people. So when desegregation occurred, black folk felt that the best way to get better was to move into the suburbs, and those communities disintegrated. Chinatowns didn't disintegrate because Chinese are not, in those particular communities, are not brainwashed to say we are inferior. So we had not only desegregation, which was a kind of a bill of goods for the United, for black folk, but we also had a campaign that was effective in making us feel that if we weren't living by white people, that somehow we were bad. And then I think sometimes we've got to ask some very, very uncomfortable questions. I know today that Barack Obama's new book, Of Thee I Sing, came out. It's a 31-page book, his first children's book. And he cites 13 great Americans, and he wrote the book for his two lovely daughters. There's three blacks mentioned in this book, and this is what I mean by brainwashing. Martin Luther King, of course, Billie Holiday, an entertainer, and Jackie Robinson, an athlete. He also says a great American, and this book is being directed to black children, was George Washington, you know, America's first elected slaveholding president. So if I tell my children that a great American is somebody who imprisoned my ancestors, that brainwashes this child to say, look up to you wouldn't find a Jewish person, for example, Mark, saying, let's celebrate a dead Nazi. You wouldn't celebrate that. You just wouldn't find it.
No, you would not.
You know, and
no, you would not.
So I think that what we've got to do is ask some difficult questions about how we are subtly teaching our children to be inferior, to think that they are inferior, and to point the finger at white supremacy's grip on not only our communities but our minds as well, where we spend our dollars, what we think about.
And we don't want to talk about people are very loath to do this, and I've said it more than once. I'm not painting everybody in the Tea Party movement or everybody who's conservative, anybody who's in the Republican Party with this brush, because I don't believe that in my heart. I don't believe conservatism is equated with racism. I don't believe any of that. However, what you said about being tainted by white supremacy, that movement is tainted by white supremacy because that's part of the root of what is opposing the idea of where America is going. And that's part of the reality. And we have to wrestle with a lot of truths that are uncomfortable for all of us to wrestle with, I think. And I think that this report, I mean, I'm glad it came out. But there needs to be a movement built in America. There needs to be a push for a new America. That's got to go beyond where we are if we're going to survive as a people, if these children are going to survive. I mean, because it's not the children that we of our inner cities are not just black people's children. And I'm going to throw this out here. I mean, it's not, these are our children. These are America's children. And as long as we keep saying, oh, they're the black children, and these are it's a black community's responsibility, these are our children. Yeah. You know? I mean, it's our America that we're talking about. And that's being built. And so it's like, I think it's a dangerous trick to say, well, this has to become the black community's responsibility. This is an American responsibility.
Well, I think in one respect, yes, you're absolutely right. But if we as black people don't care, who is going to care ultimately? And that's what we see every day in society. So I think if it's a groundswell from us, then it's going to move up the ranks. And if I'm interested in what happens to the least of them, then maybe you may be, he may be, more people will be. But I think it definitely starts in our community, because as Dr. Winbush indicated, if this was a issue about white men or white males, oh my goodness, we would have news. Everybody would be putting all their resources into fixing this problem. School system, people would be fired, new people be coming in. It would be a catastrophic event if this was something happening in white community.
But let me just throw this out again, and I'm making it. But I think it's, I'm just because this coming to me as we're talking. I just keep. I want you to jump here. Then we will go to the phones. I promise, folks. Come right to your calls. I want you to get into this. That I would also submit, America doesn't care about white kids in Appalachia. What are they doing for the white kids in Appalachia? They're letting their mountaintops be blown off. They're letting them be poisoned by cancerous materials in their waters. Do they care about those white kids in Appalachia or in West Texas? We don't care about those kids. Or in Oregon, we don't care about those kids. Do we care about Native American kids and what happens to them? We don't care about those children either. We don't care about poor people, period, in America. Period. And it's worse with the history of racism and slavery in America, what's happening to the African American community and what's happening to the Native community in these countries, in our country, where the unemployment rate on a reservation could be 85%, close to that in many inner city neighborhoods in America. But we don't care about poor people in America, period.
And I think that's a wonderful – I mean, that's a intersection between race and economics that we could really just dive down into, and you raise great examples there. And even as we talk about, you know, these black children are America's children, I would just say that in agreement – that it is, I believe, a part of the black community's responsibility to lead in that effort and shape new questions, because obviously the old questions and the old solutions and the old funding for the old programs are not working for African people. And so we have to be the ones to lead that, and we would not expect any other people group to expect other people to come in and lead in their efforts. And so in the same spirit of self-determination, if we allow other people outside of the African community to dictate, define, and decide the roles and solutions, then that just even if they're benevolent people from benevolent white people, those who classify themselves as white, benevolent, smiling white, you know, allies, you know, consider themselves allies of African people. What happens is that the same social arrangement can be perpetuated in terms of African people playing secondary roles to their own destiny and their own future, and that just continues this cycle of white supremacy, racism in our communities. And so, yes, it is an all-in together, but African people have to be in that lead of deciding, determining, and defining how do we get there, where do we go. After all, I'm the one who gave birth to Heber and Ethan. After all, I'm the one who knows them better than anybody else. And so, you know, just in that whole sense of just how we develop true coalitions, and I know, Mark, you would appreciate this, true coalitions and partnerships that kind of really bring people together around some new solutions.
Well, just like the movement that you are in the leadership of to stop the building of this new jail downtown, the youth prison that we want to build. Mm-hmm. Instead of kind of figuring out a new way to take care of our children in trouble of the law, we want to build a prison instead to lock more young black men up.
Right.
But you won't stop that jail. People will not stop that jail unless the movement that stops that jail is a movement that crosses, for the moment, say congregational lines that are white, black, Asian across the line that are standing outside saying no together. It won't be stopped without that.
And I'm thankful for those who came out on Youth Justice Sunday. It was, I mean, for that picture there, it was beautiful in that it was intergenerational. One, we don't see a lot of that, you know, going on in the city. And there were people, there were non-African people, non-people of color who were there in support all the way up through and to the civil disobedience. And so we celebrate and welcome that. And yes, we're thankful for those pastors who and churches and people who stand up and say, listen, this is wrong. I recognize racism when I see it. And when we talk about, you know, what if the nightly news said instead of little Johnny in East Baltimore got arrested tonight for locking up, you know, for hitting somebody over the head with a bat. What if the nightly news says something like, you know, here are the faces of the middle-aged white men who became millionaires this month because of the profiteering off of the incarceration of black youth?
Right.
Now you got a different
angle. Now we should
angle.
Put that. I like to put that on
and
the
put
air.
Their faces right. up. Now, these are nice white guys. These are nice middle-aged white guys. But they're profiting off of this system that is destroying our community. And so it takes – it does take African people and white allies who really are hip to that and really can speak to that and say, listen, go back – black folk go to the black community. White folk, y'all go to the white community. Y'all tell them white folks, listen, this is what is needed in our communities, because many times white folks have access to social circles and power circles and dynamics that people of color do not have access to.
I thought before we go to break, then when we come back from break, we're going to go right to Corey. You're the first. Corey and then Jay and Clarence in that order when we come back from this break. But you want to take us to break?
Yeah. The only thing that I would probably differ with you, Mark, on as far as like poor whites in Appalachia is that poor whites in Appalachia are not seen as a threat to this country.
No,
when I hear the Tea Party movement, and I don't want to paint a broad stroke, but I will paint a narrow stroke. They're talking about returning to the past, about something to a better time for white folks. You know, the Glenn Beck rally was like a pity party for white America to say, oh, woe is us. The fact of the matter is that whites, many whites, see blacks as a threat in this country. Barack Obama confirmed their worst fears that they're going to take over this country, and that's why they want it back. And I think that as long as whites have this inherent fear almost of black America, they'll love our jazz. They like to see Will Smith. You know, Jay-Z's book they're going to read, but they still see a fundamental threat, you know, to black men particularly, and that's why they lock them up. That's why they lock them up.
And we've created an image of black men, especially young black men in society, as beasts, something to be fearful of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's – well, let's take a break. We'll come back. And I promise, folks, as soon as we come back from this break, go right to Corey in Baltimore County who's waiting – Jay, you're next, and then Clarence. 410-319-8888 is the number here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and support for WEAA is provided by Mid-Atlantic Neurosurgical Associates, MANA, a center dedicated to those who suffer from brain, spine, and pain disorders. With 3 Baltimore locations, MANA's team of pain management physicians and surgeons provide a wide range of sensitive and compassionate treatment options to improve the health and well-being of its patients. For more information online, manapaincenter.com or 410-601-8314. We're talking about the report that came out in this last week from the Great City Schools, Council of Great City Schools, called A Call for Change, which talks about the situation of young black men and black men in America. A crisis, they say, a catastrophe for America. And I guess what we posited at the very beginning of the show is it is a crisis, but it certainly isn't news. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can watch us streaming live at steinershow.org with our 3 guests who are well worth the look. Dr. Raymond Winbush, who is director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. Afra Vance White, who is director of Building Strong Families at the Center for Urban Families. And the Reverend Heber Brown, pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore. 410-319-8888. And Corey, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Welcome.
Just want to say, you know, I've been listening to this show, you know, each evening, and I found out that, you know, the subject of that we're talking about tonight is simply, as stated already, this is no news. Absolutely, it is not new news. I actually pastor a church, a small church in Baltimore City, and as you were talking about the subject, it hit home with me because I sat the young men at my church, the men at my church down after service just this last week, and I asked all of them, I couldn't figure out why it was so hard for me to, you know, get them together to do, you know, things in ministry, to work with them, you know, try to, you know, just to get a hold to them. And it dawned on me that every single man in our church has been raised without a present father in the home. That was simply astounding. Not one man could raise their hand to say that their father was present during the time that they were raised. And so I found out if we want to correct the issues that we have going on amongst our men, our young black men, and men all across America, it first of all begins inside the home. As Mr. Steiner says, it's not just a problem in the, you know, for our black people, but this is America's problem. But as has been stated also, that this is a problem that we do as black men have to address. And what I found out over time is that programs do not work. Programs do not work, but programs always fail. And what I think has to happen is that we have to take a more firsthand approach. Beginning with the fathers, where are the fathers? If the fathers are absent, where are the uncles, the grandfathers, the brothers, the pastors, the deacons of the church? You know, men that are on the scene have to step in and fill those gaps to address these issues. Otherwise, as stated, if we don't take interest in the issues that are going on within our community, within our homes, we surely can't expect for somebody else to develop a greater interest in our problems without addressing the issues ourselves and sticking to it. You know, after a 6-week program or, you know, a 3-week course on something, this, that, and the other, then what? This has to be dealt with on a daily basis, day to day, day in and day out. Because one of the issues I found out with, like I said, within our churches, that I have some men of our church that have issues that know us very well will call my wife rather than call me first, because I believe that this is a problem, because they don't know how to relate to a man, because they've been raised in a home by a single parent, by a single mother, and
Ray, waiting to get this to respond. Ray,
this is Brother Corey Witherspoon. Hello?
Is Corey still there? What happened to him?
Well, I hope you're listening, Corey. See, I agree with everything you say, but I think the intervention has to be two-pronged. It has to be with asking the question, why aren't there black men in your church who had black fathers, uncles, and whatever? And the second question has to be, what do we do about the system that creates that in the first place? See, something got lost in the civil, my sister Afra just mentioned it. In the 60s, we said, look, we have inferior schools because of racism. So we've got to deal with educating our children, but we also have to intervene through civil rights, civil disobedience, the system that created those schools in the first place. Now we tend to say it's all about blaming us for the problems. And I'm saying it's still the two-pronged issue, and we have to attack it on two fronts.
And I also want to say that I think programs do work. Coming from the Center for Urban Families and running several programs for African-American men and women, I think that the information that they get in these programs are invaluable, and that it's a stepping stone. It's not the end-all solution, but it's definitely a stepping stone. So if I'm educated on something that I didn't know before, now I know, now I can build upon that and try to garner self-sufficiency. And I think that's important. I think that we cannot forget that education is very important in making changes in society in general.
Anybody want to join us before we go back to the phones?
No, I know the lines are jumping, man. Let's keep it rolling.
Let's go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. I want to come back to this, what Corey was talking about, programs. But let's go back to the phones first. 410-319-8888. Tim in Washington, D.C., you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. I actually would like to implore all of you all to use outside of the box thinking, because I think that's where the answer is. I believe that, like myself, I think we're almost too smart in the sense that we're almost book smart. What I'm talking about is we need to question the fundamental values of this society and how we have been indoctrinated with those values. I'm going to give an example, and Pastor, forgive me for saying this. The nuclear family, I think, is a failure. And we need to reexamine whether the nuclear family as a institution is still viable, and whether the needs of the children and the society and the community can still be met. That's just one example of this outside-the-box thinking. Mm-hmm. I just want to hear somebody's feedback on that example for outside-the-box thinking, for finding solutions to these problems, because as you guys have said over and over again, this is old news, and the same solutions are coming out. Fathers, black and fathers, we're almost talking about symptoms. We talked about the flame, the fire and the flames.
Mm-hmm.
We're really dealing with the symptoms. Jails, family, divorce, those are all symptoms of the underlying problem. Racism is here to stay, guys. It's not going to go anywhere. So the question is, how do we adapt to these institutionalized attacks on our family and on our families and us as people?
Well, Heber?
Yeah, let me say,
Pastor Heber Brown is what I'm calling on Heber here since you were called out.
My mama called me Heber. It's good. I would say first, as Dr. King said, I will forever remain maladjusted to the racism, white supremacy, and oppression of my people. I'll never get comfortable with that. Number two, the caller talked about being outside of the box. Well, he just burned the box up to suggest that the family is the problem. We need to just, you know.
He didn't say it was the problem. He did say that.
The nuclear family is a failure.
Right.
He said the nuclear family is a failure. And just studying just the African characteristics and culture just of people, we are communal people. We call each other brother and sister. Some of our white brothers and sisters come to my church, and we walk around in church, and we'll say, hey, sister so-and-so, hey, brother so-and-so. And they say, Heber, you're related to all these people?
They do not say that.
Yes, they do. And I say, listen. And they go and tell their friends, Heber knows everybody. I say, listen, we are communal people, and so we tend to, even my wife's family down in Chattanooga, Tennessee, they don't even call each other by their names. They call each other by their relationships. And so they'll say, hey, brother, come over here, sister. And so we are communal people, and so I don't understand that logic that says the nuclear family is a failure. I would go to other end and say, you know what, the family needs to be strengthened. The community needs to regain and reclaim that communal aspect of just who God made us to be.
But maybe one of the things that Corey is saying, though, and we'll go back to that Tim was saying, then we'll go to Clarence, the next caller, is that the families throughout history have changed. I mean, the nuclear family, as we talk about it today, it's a relatively new phenomenon in the world. It's not something that, you know, and that maybe what he's saying is we're seeing families being redefined in America. That the nature of family is being redefined. You know, I mean, as someone on this program said the other day, in a controversial way, in her studies, that a single mother raising a child is not a barrier to the middle class. There are other barriers to the middle class. And she has all these interesting sociologists here talking about that. And that, I mean, because either if you are an upper middle class woman or a middle class woman with a decent job and a child, you can still make it financially, and we'll make it. And the child may make it as well. So I think maybe that's what he was saying, but I think that what you're saying about the larger community thing is very, very powerful and very important. I mean, because that is the case. I mean, and also very funny what you said about white folks coming to your church. I'm surprised that people aren't a little hipper than that at this moment in their lives.
If I could just comment real quick on what you just said, mm-hmm. Mark, mainly because it hit home. I am a single mother, and I think that I do very well. I'm divorced. However, without my ex-husband involved actively in my daughter's life,
right.
I think it would be a disservice to her. I agree. From a two-parent household, and it is my father who helps me to have positive male relationships. Not necessarily intimate, but just positive. Mm-hmm. And it helps me to love myself so that I don't make bad decisions, picking not the right man and the such. So I think that even with being, I don't think being a single mother is a barrier to self-sufficiency or success even. But I think it's important that we understand that it's important for that child to have their father actively involved in their life. If not financially, every day just I'm picking up my daughter to play with her, just in their lives, doing something with their child. And that's important. And I don't think that's ever going to not be important.
Fathers and men need to be in the lives of families and children.
Exactly.
Yeah, they do.
410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Clarence.
Quick reflection and a couple comments, please. Almost 30 years ago, I had the pleasure of hearing a man down in Atlanta by the name of Jose Williams.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The greatest battle that you will face as a parent, in a black parent in America, will be keeping your children out of the system. He said that almost 30 years ago. I will never forget it.
Let me interrupt, because people who don't know Jose Williams, he was one of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a colleague of Martin Luther King, a great civil rights hero. So I just want to let people know who you're talking about. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Clarence.
It was an honor to be in his presence. If you draw a triangle and you put social segregation on one point, economic deprivation on the other point, and educational deprivation on the other point, mm-hmm. and you throw a jail in the center of it, those on the inside of that have no way out of it. There's no way out of that triangle, especially when you throw all the other social ills inside of that triangle, guns, drugs, alcohol, and all of the rest of it. You're just bouncing around on the inside of that triangle, and no matter how, without the education and out the economics, you're still socially segregated, and you're powerless. That triangle must be attacked by those who are standing on the outside of it. It must be attacked that way. Those of us who have outside of that triangle, who have the vote, political power, must attack that triangle. That's the only way that me personally I see it. And two other points I'd like to make. One of the worst social conditions that I see may be necessary in this climate is that inside of that triangle, the jails, our black women are turning the keys in it, seeing our women, our menfolk, under the worst conditions. I mean, I just have a pet peeve with that. Also, I'd like to say that I view this movement, the power structure, the Tea Party, as something that I've seen, the power structure that's been in place all of my life. It's part of the same thing that created these social conditions for my 57 years on the planet. So that's all I would like to say.
Thank you, Clarence. You said a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing. Members. You know, as an academic, when I think the caller is right on point on everything he said, that if I say I'm going to write a grant, you know, proposal to get money for teenage pregnancy in the black community or drug abuse in the black community, that would be good, or violence in the black community, I'll give money for that. If I say I'm going to write a proposal that says I want to do a conference on white supremacy in the black community, they'll tell you, we don't fund that. We won't fund that. Eric Holder, bless his heart, almost a little over a year ago, got up and said, we are a nation of cowards when it comes to discussing race. And you would have thought that he lit a match. I mean, it was like incredible. Because this is a nation of cowards when it comes to discussing race. And as the caller said, you got to work on the outside of the triangle, and you've got to be willing to deal with this issue of racism, white supremacy, in all of its form. One other quick thing about Obama's book.
Please.
It was interesting that faux news rather than Fox News. They came out and denounced the book.
Denounced it?
Because Obama had included Sitting Bull as one of his 13 heroes. And they said because Fox News condemned the book because it said that he embraced a great American general. Armstrong Custer was one of the dumbest generals that ever lived. And because Obama cited him as a hero, they saw Obama as a, quote, reverse racist for lifting up a Native American person who had killed a dumb white general at the Little Bighorn. But see, what I admire about that mentality is that they are intact with their white view of history. They are committed to it. they will do anything to make sure that it's in the curriculum and is perpetuated, and they will condemn a president for even mildly going against that.
You see, and one of the things, and we'll go to the phones, Robin and Iris, and folks, if some of the guys who are hanging on, I'll be very frank. The reason I haven't gotten your calls yet is because you call on a lot, and all these new callers are calling. I'm going to get some new voice on the air, which y'all are always welcome because we love you, but I want to get some new voices on here as well. 410-319-8888. But that's the other. There's another divide in America. I call it the crazy horse Custer divide, where people we have this view of history, and this coming year in May is the 135th anniversary of the Battle of Little Bighorn. We're going to be doing a bunch around that instantly there, and hopefully out west, because I think that
that's going to be interesting.
Because that is a big piece of. We have a lot of divides here in America, and that clearly is one of those major divides. And as my friend John Trudell, the Native American poet and writer, always says, when he said, "Who is your favorite philosopher?" He always says, "Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse." So we'll deal with that another day. 410-319-8888. Let us go to Robin in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Mrs. Steiner, and hi to your panel
welcome.
Guest. I think I'm a few topics off, but I just wanted to make a comment on the core family and the family structure.
No, please. You're not off. That's what we're talking about.
Okay. And I guess, you know, I am a single parent, but I co-parent, and I feel like it's so vital, and I feel like I allow it to happen, and I really, you know, look at our society, and, you know, one thing that sticks out like a sore thumb is that breakdown in the family, and everybody has so many good ideas, and I hear so many, you know, wonderful programs that are going on, and it seems like the answers are out there. I don't know how we bring it all together. It just seems like it's so difficult to attack it. But I think that one of the real, you know, as a family and what I want for my family is something I have to personally take on and be invested in. And I guess when you look at our society today, that's where you see so much, so many things have been relaxed when it was so vital for us and how I was raised. I'm trying to impart that on, you know, to my daughter, but you see so many families that are going to miss the boat if they, you know, you got to stay in the game. You're just not going to ever be perfect, but we just have to, you know, fix our families. I think that's just such a core thing for education, for so many different ills that we have in our societies. And how you do it, I don't really know, but I just feel like that's, you know, going to be so meaningful if we can attack the family structure and get that back intact to a point where it can become effective and the traditions can be passed on to the degree that we're not so far away from how I was raised. You know, I feel like how kids are being raised now and how I was raised is just light years apart. Hmm. And it didn't seem that way years ago.
Thank you
so
much.
That's all I want to say.
No, Robin, I thank you so much. You know how many times that we hear that cry about what it was once?
Yeah.
And what people have said in the past that the structure that kept black community together was the family. Surviving through all the madness of slavery, segregation, and racism.
And it's interesting that the attack on the black family is over 400 years old. When you talk about the selling of black children, the rape of black women, the castration of black men, and throughout all of the period of enslavement, dividing the black family. Herb Gutman, his book says it's a miracle that the black family survived, given all of what it did up until the year 1920. I mean, by all logic, the black family should have been utterly destroyed. But, you know, like Maya Angelou says, we still rise, and we just have to understand what we are rising to and how we could continue the journey.
Afra?
I just totally agree, and you know, that was 400 years of oppression. We're just 150 so years out of it, and my math might be slightly off. But, I mean, so we need more time.
Right.
It doesn't happen overnight, and we still have to deal with social racism, basically. We still have to deal with that while we're trying to build ourselves back up from the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of oppression and slavery.
Yeah, very quickly, I would just add,
we need more time, and we also need a new operating system. As I look at this wonderful iPad in front of me, we need a new operating system.
We all want his iPad, don't we?
Yes, but but you know, if we just continue to kind of plot along with the same orientation. And continue to just think back on days of yesterday and say, oh, wasn't it good back then? You know, we'll have great parties and talking about it, but, you know, to really do it, it's going to take some work. It's going to take a new operating system. We need new ways to talk about each other as African people, new ways to relate to one another between black men and black women, new ways. You're not going to see it on TV. You're not going to see it on nightly news. You're not going to see it in the movies or in the songs by the hip-hop rappers. But we need to develop some new guidelines, a new spirit, a new system in which to relate one to another, and then a new system to relate from as a community to other communities as well.
We'll go back to the phones here. And let me also posit that one of the things that we need to hear in America, given that we are in a era where we're thinking that we've gone beyond race, I think is the term people are using now in America.
Post-racial
society. That we've changed a lot in terms of race, and the white world has changed a lot in terms of race in America. Mm-hmm. Over 43% of the people who are white in America wouldn't have voted for Barack Obama in the first place. Mm-hmm. 57% did not.
That's right.
But it's still that the conversation that we're having here, at least from my perspective, has to somehow be a broader conversation that crosses over into many communities to have the honest conversation that Eric Holder is saying America needs to have.
We resist.
And I just have to say that we are having that conversation tomorrow from 2 to 8
yes,
p.m.
Yes, please.
And
Raymond Wimbush will be
our keynote speaker at the Center for Urban Families, 2201 North Monroe Street, Baltimore, Maryland. But our whole topic is the Black family today and beyond. And it's a community conversation on family strengthening. So we're inviting educators, community people in general. If you live in the neighborhood, come on out. But it's definitely important that you be there, because we're talking about exactly that, what we're going to do to make it better. We're talking about the change necessary to strengthen our families.
And I want to make sure people... Thanks, Raymond. So, and the number is 410-246-1388, Aaron Nelson's number, anelson@cfuf.org. So it's tomorrow from 2 to 8 p.m., make as much of it as you can. Dr. Raymond Wimbush, our guest tonight, author of The Warrior Method, A Parent's Guide to Rearing Healthy Black Boys, will be the keynote speaker at 5 p.m. So I know I want you to hear my show tomorrow, but I want you to hear Dr. Raymond Wimbush too. So figure out how you can do both at the same time. Dr. Raymond Wimbush, Reverend Heber Brown, Afra Vance White, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you all in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And I want to tell you the support for WEAA is provided by Chef Max Louisiana Cuisine, available for catering for all holiday parties and special occasions, open Monday through Thursday, 12 to 8 p.m., and Fridays and Saturdays, 12 to 9 p.m., located at 4311 Harford Road, 410-319-6227. That's 410-319-6227. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we start our free speech TV portion, still streaming live on the web at steinershow.org, and, of course, right here at 88.9 FM. The voice of the community here at Morgan State University here in Baltimore, Maryland. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Robert Kuttner about the economic crisis in America and what they say we should do with the deficit reduction. He thinks it's bunk. We're going to talk about why. Then we're going to talk with the leaders of the International Labor Organization from Geneva, Switzerland, to talk about what the situation about labor and poverty is in the world, how it affects us all. Stay with us for that. Don't go away.